Changed as clouds change. New vineyards, forests, villages, houses and gardens sprang up, approached, rolled past. The chestnut tree moved onward, the wood nymph moved with it. Locomotive after locomotive roared past each other, crisscrossing paths. The locomotives sent up clouds that formed shapes telling of Paris, which was where they came from and where the wood nymph was headed. Surely everything around her knew and understood where she was going. She thought that every tree she passed was stretching out its branches toward her and pleading, "Take me along, take me along!" Inside every tree lived another wood nymph, filled with yearning. What changes! What speed! The buildings seemed to shoot up from the earth, more and more of them, closer and closer together. The chimneys rose up like flower pots, stacked on top of each other, and side by side along the rooftops. Enormous inscriptions composed of letters 2 feet high and painted shapes that shone brightly covered the walls from foundation to cornice. "Where does Paris start, and when will I be there?" the wood nymph asked herself. The crowds of people swelled, the bustle and commotion grew, carriage followed carriage. There were people on foot and on horseback, and everywhere shop after shop, music, song, shrieks and conversations. The wood nymph in her tree was in the middle of Paris. The big heavy cart came to a halt in a little square planted with trees and surrounded by tall buildings. Every window had its own balcony with people looking down at the young, fresh chestnut tree that came riding along and was now to be planted here in place of the dead, uprooted tree that lay stretched out on the ground. People on the square stopped and gazed with smiles and pleasure at the springtime greenery. The older trees, still in bud, rustled their branches in greeting. "Welcome, welcome." And the fountain, which tossed its jets of water into the air to make them splash into the wide basin, let the wind carry drops over to the newly arrived tree, as if offering a drink in welcome. The wood nymph felt her tree being lifted out of the cart and placed at its future site. The tree's roots were covered with earth. Fresh sod was laid on top. Blossoming shrubs and pots containing flowers were planted just like the tree. An entire garden plot was created in the middle of the square. The dead, uprooted tree, killed by gas fumes, cooking fumes, and the plant-suffocating city air, was put on the cart and driven away. The crowds of people watched. Children and old people sat on the benches outdoors and looked up through the tree's foliage. And we who are telling this story stood on the balcony, looking down at the young springtime from the fresh country air, and said, as the old priest would have said, "You poor wood nymph." "How happy I am! How happy!" said the wood nymph. "And yet I can't quite grasp it, can't express what I feel. Everything is just as I imagined, and yet not as I imagined." The buildings stood so tall, so close together. The sun shone directly on only one wall, which was pasted over with placards and posters. People stood in front, jostling each other. Wagons, both light and heavy, raced past. Omnibuses, those packed moving houses, sped by. Riders on horseback raced off. Carts and carriages vied for the right of way. The wood nymph thought, if only the buildings, grown so tall and standing so close together, would start moving too, changing shape the way the clouds in the sky change, sliding aside so she would be able to see into Paris, look out over it. Notre Dame would appear, Place Vendôme and the wonder that had summoned and was still summoning all the foreigners here. The buildings did not budge. It was still daylight when the lamps were lit and the gas light streamed from the shops, shining through the branches of the tree. It was like summer sunshine. The stars overhead appeared, the same ones the wood nymph had seen back home. She thought she could sense a breeze coming from there, pure and gentle. She felt uplifted, strengthened, and sensed a visual force penetrating every leaf of her tree, an awareness in the very tips of its roots. She found herself in the midst of the living world of humans, observed by gentle eyes. All around were sounds and commotion, colours and light. From the side streets came the sound of wind instruments and the tunes of barrel organs made for dancing. Oh, yes, for dancing, for dancing! For joy and pleasure they played. It was music that would make people, horses, carriages, trees, and buildings dance if they could dance. An intoxicating joy rose inside the wood nymph's breast. "How blissful and lovely," she rejoiced. "I'm in Paris!" The next day, the night that followed, and then another day offered the same sights, the same coming and going, the same life, changing and yet always the same. "Now I know every tree, every flower on this square. I know every building, balcony, and shop where I've been placed in this cramped little corner that hides from me the magnificent great city. Where is the Arc de Triomphe, the boulevards, and the wonder of the world? I can see none of them. Imprisoned as if in a cage, I stand here among these tall buildings that I now have memorized, with their inscriptions, placards, and signs, all the painted-on delicacies that no longer appeal to me. Where is everything I've heard about, known about, longed for, and the reason I wanted to come here? What have I won, gained, found? I yearn as I did before. I sense a life I must seize and embrace. I must join the ranks of the living. Cavort among them, fly like the birds, see and feel, actually become a human being, and seize half a day of life in place of years of dwelling in the weariness and tedium of the ordinary, which will make me sicken and droop, sink like the meadow mist, and vanish. I want to gleam like the cloud, gleam in the sun of life, gaze out across everything like the cloud, race off as it does, no one knows where." This was the wood nymph's sigh, which rose up like a prayer. "Take my years of life. Give me half the life of a mayfly. Release me from my prison. Give me a human life, human happiness for one brief moment, even a single night if that's all I can have, and then punish me only for my bold love of life, my longing for life. Obliterate me. Let my husk, this fresh young tree, wither, fall, turn to ash, blow away on the wind." The branches of the tree rustled. A tickling sensation arose, a trembling in all the leaves, as if a fire were coursing through them or shooting out of them. A stormy gust blew through the tree's crown, and in the midst of it a female shape rose up, the wood nymph. The next moment she was sitting under the gas-lit, leafy branches, young and lovely, like poor Marie, to whom it was said, "The big city will be your ruin." The wood nymph sat at the foot of the tree next to her house door, which she had closed and then thrown away the key. So young, so lovely. The stars looked at her, the stars winked. The gas lamps looked at her, glittered, blinked. How slender she was, and yet so sturdy, a child and yet a full-grown maiden. Her clothing was silken, green as the fresh unfurled leaves in the tree's crown. In her nut-brown hair hung a half-open chestnut blossom. She looked like the goddess of spring. For only a brief moment did she sit there, motionless. Then she jumped up, and with the speed of a gazelle she raced off around the corner. She ran, she leaped, like the flash in a mirror that is carried in the sun, the flash that with every movement is tossed first here, then there. If anyone had taken a close look and been able to see what there was to see, how wondrous it was! At every spot where she lingered for a moment, her clothing changed, as did her shape, to match the character of that place, that building, and its lamp that shone upon her. She reached the boulevard. There a sea of light streamed from the gas flames in the street lamps, shops, and cafes. There the trees stood in rows, young and slender, each hiding its wood nymph from the rays of the artificial sunlight. The endlessly long sidewalk was like one huge banquet hall. Tables were set with all types of refreshments, from champagne and chartreuse to coffee and beer. On display were flowers, pictures, statues, books, and colourful fabrics. From amid the throngs beneath the tall buildings, she looked out across the terrifying stream in the middle of the rows of trees. There surged a river of carriages, cabriolets, coaches, omnibuses, hansom cabs, gentlemen on horseback, and marching regiments. A person risked life and limb by crossing over to the opposite shore. Now a Bengal light flared. Then the gaslight was even brighter. Suddenly a rocket shot skyward. Where did it come from? Where was it going? This was undoubtedly the great highway of the world's greatest city. Here, soft Italian melodies resounded, over there Spanish songs accompanied by the clack of castanets. But loudest of all, drowning out everything else, were the music box tunes of the day, the tingling can-can music that Orpheus never knew, nor was it ever heard by the beautiful Helen. Even the wheelbarrow would have danced on its wheel, if it could have managed to dance at all. The wood nymph danced, swayed, flew, her colours changing like a hummingbird in the sunlight, reflecting every building and the world inside. Like the gleaming lotus blossom torn loose from its root and borne by the current and its eddies, she drifted away, and wherever she paused she would take on yet another shape. That's why no one was able to follow, recognise or observe her. Like cloud images, everything flew past her, face after face, but not one did she know. Not a single figure from her home region did she see. In her mind, two radiant eyes shone. She was thinking about Marie. Poor Marie. That ragged, happy child with the red flower in her black hair. She was here in the great city, rich and radiant, like the time she drove past the priest's house, the wood nymph's tree and the old oak. She was most assuredly here in the deafening din, perhaps having just alighted from that magnificent waiting coach. Splendid carriages were stopped here. The coachman wore braided livery. The servants wore silk stockings. The noble passengers stepping out were all women, richly attired ladies. They walked through the open gates and up the steep, wide staircase that led to a building with marble-white pillars. Could this be the wonder of the world? Marie must be here. Sancta Maria, they sang inside. The fragrance of incense came billowing out from the high, painted and gilded arches where semi-darkness dwelled. It was the Madeleine Church. Dressed in black attire made from the costliest fabrics, tailored in the latest and highest fashion, the elegant feminine world glided across the polished floor. Their crests were engraved on the silver clasps of the velvet-bound prayer books and embroidered on the fine, strongly perfumed handkerchiefs, trimmed with costly Brussels lace. Some of the women knelt in quiet prayer before the altars, others sought out the confessionals. The wood nymph felt uneasy and alarmed, as if she had set foot in a place she should not enter. This was the home of silence, the great hall of secrets, where everything was whispered and soundlessly confided. The wood nymph saw herself enshrouded in silk and a veil, her figure resembling that of the other wealthy, high-born women. Was each of them a child full of yearning like herself? A sigh so painfully deep was heard. Did it come from the confessional corner, or from the wood nymph's breast? She drew the veil more closely around her. She was breathing in the church incense, and not fresh air. This was not the place of her longing. Away, away, flee without rest. The mayfly does not rest. Her flight is her life. She was once again outside beneath the glittering gas candelabras near the magnificent fountains. Yet all the torrents of water do not have the power to rinse away the innocent blood shed here. Those were the words that were spoken. Foreigners stood there conversing loudly and animatedly, the way no one had dared in the great hall of secrets that the wood nymph had just left. A great stone slab was turned, lifted. She did not understand. She looked at the open stairs descending into the depths of the earth. They led downward, away from the starry bright air, away from the sun-gleaming gas flames, away from the world of the living. "I'm afraid," said one of the women standing there. "I don't dare go down inside, nor do I care to see the splendour below. Stay here with me."
"And go back home?" said the man. "Leave Paris without seeing the most remarkable, the truest wonder of the day, created by the ingenuity and will of one man?"
"I'm not going down there," was the reply. The wonder of the day, he had said. The wood nymph heard it and understood. The goal of her greatest longing had been reached, and here was the entrance, down into the depths, beneath Paris. It was not as she had imagined, but she had heard him say that, had watched the strangers descend, and she followed them. The stairs were made of cast iron, spiral-shaped, wide and comfortable. A single lamp was lit below and another farther down. They were standing in a labyrinth of endlessly long, intersecting halls and arched passageways. All the streets and lanes of Paris were here to see, as if in a dim mirror image. The names could be read, and each building above had its number below. Their roots shot out under the deserted asphalt pavements that squeezed along a wide canal with sludge gushing along. Higher up, fresh running water was conducted through an aqueduct, and above everything hung a network of gas pipes and telegraph wires. Lamps glowed in the distance like reflections from the metropolis overhead. Now and then a great rumbling could be heard up above from heavy carts driving across the underground entrances. Where was the wood nymph? You've heard about the catacombs? They're nothing more than faint wisps compared to this new underground world, this modern-day wonder, the sewers of Paris. That was where the wood nymph now stood, and not at the World Exposition at Champ de Mars. Cries of amazement, admiration, and acknowledgement she heard. From down here, they said, health and long years of life are now made possible for thousands upon thousands up above. Our age is the age of progress with all its blessings. That was the opinion of the humans, the words of the humans, but not of the creatures that had been born and lived down there, the rats. They were squeaking from the crevice in a section of old wall, so loud and clear that the wood nymph could understand them. A big old male rat with a bitten-off tail piercingly screeched his fury, his worry, the one and only right opinion, and his family agreed with every word.
"I'm sickened by that meowing, that human meowing, that ignorant talk. Oh, yes, things are certainly lovely down here with gas and petroleum, but that's not something I can eat. Everything has become so fine and bright down here that it makes you sit around feeling ashamed without knowing why. If only we were living in the age of tallow candles. That wasn't so long ago. It was a romantic time, they say."
"What are you saying?" asked the wood nymph. "I didn't notice you before. What are you talking about?"
"About the good old days," said the rat. "Those gracious days of great-grandfather and great-grandmother rat. Back then it was a grand occasion to come down here. It was a rat's nest beyond any in all of Paris. Mother Plague lived down here then. She killed human beings, but never rats. Thieves and smugglers breathed freely down here. It was a refuge for the most interesting characters, who are now seen only in the melodramas up above. The romantic age is over, even in our rat's nest. We now have fresh air down here.
And petroleum."
That was what the rat was squeaking. He squeaked at the new age and praised the past with its mother plague. A cart was waiting, a kind of open omnibus with small lively horses harnessed in front. The group climbed in to rush off along Boulevard Sebastopol, the underground one. Right overhead stretched the familiar one crowded with people up in Paris. The cart vanished in the semi-darkness. The wood nymph vanished, rising up in the glimmer of gas flames into the fresh air. Up there, and not down below among the intersecting vaults and their muffled air, would the wonder be found, the wonder of the world, the one she was seeking in her brief lifetime. Surely it would shine brighter than all the gas flames below, brighter than the moon that was now gliding into view. Yes, of course. She saw it in the distance. It was shining before her, glinting, winking, like Venus in the sky. She saw a radiant gate that stood open to a little garden filled with lights and dance melodies. The gas lights shone like borders of flowers around quiet little lakes and ponds where water plants, artificially made, cut from sheets of tin then bent and painted, glittered in all that light, shooting 2-foot-high jets of water from their chalices. Beautiful weeping willows, the real weeping willows of spring, lowered their fresh boughs like a green veil, transparent and yet concealing. Here among the shrubbery burned a bonfire, its red gleam casting light over the small, dim, silent arbours, pulsating with tunes, music that tickled the ear, enchanting, enticing, chasing the blood through people's limbs. She saw young women, beautiful and festively dressed, with guileless smiles and the light laughing temperament of youth. A Marie with a rose in her hair but without a carriage or groom. How they surged! How they whirled around in their wild dance! What was up? What was down? As if bitten by the tarantella, they leaped, they laughed, they smiled, blissfully happy to embrace the whole world. The wood nymph felt herself swept up by the dance. Her elegant little feet wore silk slippers, chestnut brown like the ribbon that fluttered from her hair over her bare shoulders. Her green silk gown billowed in great folds, but without hiding her beautifully shaped legs and exquisite feet that seemed to want to sketch magical circles in the air before the face of the dancing young man. Was she in Armida's enchanted garden? What was this place called? The name was lit up outside in the gas flames. Mabille. Tunes and applause, rockets and trickling water pierced by the pop of champagne corks. The wild dancing was bacchanalian, and over it all sailed the moon, its face a bit skewed. The sky without a cloud, clear and pure, it seemed possible to look straight into heaven from Mabille. A consuming, urgent joie de vivre shuddered through the wood nymph like the intoxication of opium. Her eyes spoke, her lips spoke, but the words were not heard above the clamour of flutes and violins. Her dancing partner whispered words in her ear that rippled in time with the can-can. She didn't understand them. We didn't understand them. He stretched out his arms toward her, around her, and embraced nothing but the transparent, gas-filled air. The wood nymph was carried off by a current of air the way the wind carries a rose petal. From high above she saw before her a flame, a flickering blaze high atop a tower. The fire gleamed from the object of her longing, gleamed from the red lighthouse on the Fata Morgana of Champ de Mars. That was where she was carried by the spring wind. She circled the tower, and the workers thought it was a butterfly they were watching descend, only to die, having arrived too soon. The moon glittered, the gas lights and lanterns lit up the great buildings, and the halls of nations scattered all around, illuminating the heights of the green lawns and the rocks so ingeniously man-made, where waterfalls poured down under the power of Master Bloodless. The caverns of the sea and the depths of the freshwater lakes, the realms of the fish, opened here. You were at the bottom of the deep ponds. You were under the sea in a glass diving bell. Water pressed against the thick glass walls on all sides and from above. Polyps, fathoms long, slithery and wriggling like eels, alive and quivering, intestines and arms, seized hold, rose up, became rooted to the sea floor. An enormous wary flounder lay nearby, indolently, comfortably spreading itself out. Over it crawled a crab like a giant spider, while shrimp darted past with a speed and haste as if they were the moths and butterflies of the sea. In the fresh water grew water lilies, reeds, and water gladioli. Goldfish were lined up like red cows in a field, all of them with their heads turned in the same direction so the current would enter their mouths. Thick, fat tenches stared at the glass walls with dull-witted eyes. They knew they were at the Paris Exposition. They knew that in barrels filled with water they had made the quite difficult journey to come here. They had been landsick on the train the way people become seasick on the ocean. They had come to see the exposition, and see it they did from their own freshwater or saltwater box seats, watching the throngs of people moving past from morning to night. All the nations of the world had sent their humans for display, so that the old tenches and bream, the nimble perch and algae-covered carp could see the humans and voice their opinion about such creatures.
"They're scalefish," said a muddy little carp. "They change their scales 2 or 3 times a day and make mouth noises. Speech, they call it. We don't change, and we make ourselves understood in a much easier way by twitching our lips and staring with our eyes. We're much more advanced than human beings."
"Yet they have learned to swim," said a little freshwater fish. "I come from a big inland lake. During the hot days, humans come into the water, but first they take off their scales. Then they swim. The frogs taught them how, by kicking their hind legs and stroking with their front legs, though they can't do it for long. They want to be like us, but that's impossible. Poor humans."
And the fish stared. They thought the whole crowd of people they had seen in the bright daylight was still moving about. Yes, they were convinced they could still see the same figures that had first struck their nerves of perception, so to speak. A little perch, with beautiful tiger-striped skin and an enviably rounded back, swore that the human mire was still there. He could see it.
"I see it too. I see it quite clearly," said a jaundiced golden tench. "I can clearly see the beautiful shaped human form. The long-legged lady, or whatever it was they called her. She had our lips and staring eyes, two balloons behind and a closed parasol in front, great duckweed appendages, and all sorts of baubles. She should take everything off and move as we do, the way we were created to move. Then she would look like a respectable tench, as much as a human being could."
"Where did he go? The one on the rope, the male human they were pulling along?"
"He was riding in a wagon with a seat, sitting with a piece of paper, pen and ink, writing everything up, writing everything down. What was the meaning of that? They called him a writer."
"He's still riding along," said an algae-covered maidenly carp, who had the temptation of the world in her gullet. It had made her hoarse. She had once swallowed a fishhook, and was still patiently swimming around with it in her throat.
"A writer," she said, "in fish terms, in understandable terms, is a kind of octopus among humans."
That's how the fish talked. But in the midst of the artificially constructed water-bearing grotto came the sound of hammering and the songs of workers. They had to labour through the night in order to finish it all on time. They were singing in the summer night dream of the wood nymph. She stood inside, soon to fly off and vanish once more. "Goldfish," she said, nodding to them. "So I managed to see you after all." "Yes, I know you. I've known you for a very long time. The swallow told me all about you back home. How beautiful, glittering, lovely you are. I could kiss each and every one of you. I know the others, too. That must be the fat bream, and that one the delectable brace, and here are the old algae-covered carp. I know you, but you don't know me." The fish stared, not understanding a single word. They peered into the waning light. The wood nymph was no longer there. She was standing outdoors where the world's wonder blossoms spread fragrances from the various lands. From the land of rye bread, the coast of dried cod, the realm of Russian leather, the riverbank of eau de cologne, and the orient of rose oil. After a night of dancing, we drive home half asleep, and in our ears echo the melodies that we heard, still so clear that we could sing each and every one of them. And just as in the eyes of a dead man the last sight he saw lingers for a time like a photograph, so did the tumult and glare of the day remain in the night. It had not slipped away, was not yet extinguished. The wood nymph could sense this, and she knew it will still be rushing onward, even tomorrow. The wood nymph stood among the fragrant roses, thinking she recognized them from her home. Roses from the castle grounds and from the priest's garden. The red pomegranate she saw here, too, the kind that Marie had worn in her coal-black hair. Memories from her childhood home out in the country flashed through her mind. She drank in the sights all around with greedy eyes as a feverish restlessness filled her, guiding her through the wondrous halls. She felt tired, and her weariness grew. She felt an urge to rest on the soft oriental cushions and carpets spread all around inside, or to lean like a weeping willow down toward the clear water and dive in. But the mayfly never rests. The day would be over in minutes. Her thoughts trembled, her limbs shook. She sank down onto the grass beside the trickling water. "You leap from the earth with eternal life," she said. "Cool my tongue, give me refreshment."
"I am not a living fount," replied the water. "A machine makes me leap."
"Green grass, give me some of your freshness," begged the wood nymph. "Give me one of your fragrant flowers."
"We will die if you pull us out," replied the blades of grass and the flowers.
"Kiss me, you fresh gust of air, just one kiss of life."
"Soon the sun will kiss the clouds crimson," said the wind, and then you will be among the dead, passing away as all the splendour here will pass away before the year is out. Then I can once again play with the light loose sand on this site, blowing dust across the earth, dust through the air, dust, nothing but dust. The wood nymph felt a sense of dread, like the woman who has slit her wrist in the bath and is bleeding, but as she bleeds, wishes to go on living. She rose up, took a few steps forward, and then collapsed again before a little chapel. The door stood open, candles burned on the altar, the organ was playing. What music! Such tones the wood nymph had never heard, and yet within them she seemed to hear familiar voices. They came from the depths of the heart of all creation. She thought she could sense the rustling of the old oak. She thought she could hear the old priest speaking about glorious deeds, about famous names, about what God's creation might offer as gifts to a future age, and must give to it in order to win eternal life. The chords of the organ surged and resounded, saying in song, "Your longing and desire tore you up by the roots from your God-given place. It was your ruin, you poor wood nymph." The tones of the organ, soft, gentle, and sounding like sobs, died out as sobs do. In the sky the clouds gleamed crimson. The wind sighed and sang, "Away, dead ones, now the sun is rising." The first ray fell on the wood nymph. Her figure shone with shimmering colours, like a soap bubble as it bursts, vanishes, and becomes a drop, a tear, that falls to the ground and disappears. Poor wood nymph! A dewdrop, nothing but a tear that was shed and then fled. The sun shone over the Fata Morgana of Champ de Mars. It shone over Great Paris, over the little square with the trees and the splashing fountain, between the tall buildings where the chestnut tree stood, but with drooping branches, withered leaves. The tree which only yesterday stood as erect and full of life as spring itself. Now it had perished, they said. The wood nymph had perished, passed on like a cloud, and no one knew where. On the ground lay a withered, tattered chestnut blossom. Not even the holy water of the church had the power to bring it back to life. A person's foot soon crushed it into the gravel. All this happened and was witnessed. We saw it ourselves during the exposition in Paris in 1867, during our time, the great, wondrous time of fairy tales.
The Most Incredible Thing. Whoever could present the most incredible thing would have the king's daughter and half the kingdom. Those who were young, yes, even the old, strained all their thoughts, sinews, and muscles. Two of them ate themselves to death, and one died of drink while trying to do the most incredible thing, each according to his inclination. But that was not the way it should be done. Little street urchins practiced spitting on their own backs. That's what they thought was the most incredible of all. On a certain day, everything would be displayed, what each person had to show as the most incredible thing. Judges had been appointed, from 3-year-old children to people as old as 90. An entire array of incredible things was presented, but everyone quickly agreed that the most incredible of all was a large clock in a case, remarkably devised both inside and out. On the stroke of the hour, living pictures would emerge to show what hour had struck. There were 12 images in all, with moving figures that sang and spoke. "That is the most incredible thing," everyone said. The clock struck one, and Moses stood on the mountain and wrote on the law tablets the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." The clock struck two, and the Garden of Eden appeared, where Adam and Eve met, both of them happy, without owning so much as a clothes closet, nor did they need one. At the stroke of three, the three wise men appeared. One of them was coal black, but it wasn't his fault because the sun had blackened him. They brought incense and precious treasures. On the stroke of four, the seasons of the year emerged, Spring with a cuckoo on a blossoming beech branch. Summer with a grasshopper on a ripe stalk of grain. Autumn with an empty stork's nest, since the bird had flown off. Winter with an old crow who could tell stories in the corner by the stove. Old memories. When the clock struck five, the five senses appeared. Sight came as an optician, hearing as a coppersmith, smell was selling violets and woodruff, taste was a cook, and feeling was an undertaker with mourning crepe all the way down to his heels. The clock struck six, and there sat a gambler. He threw the die, and it landed with the highest number up, and there it said, six. Then the 7 days of the week appeared, or the seven deadly sins. People couldn't agree which they were, since they belonged together and weren't easy to tell apart. Then came a choir of monks singing the 8 o'clock matins. At the stroke of nine, the nine muses appeared. One was occupied with astronomy, one with the historical archives, and the rest belonged to the theatre. At the stroke of 10, Moses once again stepped forth with the law tablets on which stood the commandments of God. And there were 10. The clock struck again, and little boys and girls jumped and leaped. They were playing a game and singing along. 5, 6, 7, the clock strikes 11. And that's what it had struck. Now it struck 12, and the watchman wearing a fur cap and carrying a morning star stepped forth. He was singing the old watchman's song. It was at midnight that our Saviour was born. And as he sang, roses grew and turned into angel heads borne by rainbow-coloured wings. It was enchanting to hear. It was lovely to see. The whole thing was an incomparable work of art. It was the most incredible thing, said all the people. The artist was a young man, tender-hearted, childishly happy, a loyal friend and helpful to his impoverished parents. He deserved the princess and half the kingdom. The day of decision arrived. The whole city was decorated, and the princess sat on the throne of the realm, which had been newly stuffed with horsehair, though that hadn't made it any more easing or pleasing. All the judges cast sly glances at the one who was to win, and there he stood, so confident and joyous. His happiness was assured. He had made the most incredible thing. "No, I'm the one who's going to do it," suddenly shouted a tall, strong, bony fellow. "I'm the man for the most incredible thing." And then he swung a big axe at the work of art. Crash, bash, smash, there the whole thing lay. Gears and springs rolled all around. It was all ruined. "I'm the only one who could do it," said the man. "My deed has beaten his and beaten all of you. I have done the most incredible thing."
"Destroying a work of art like that," said the judges. "Yes, that is the most incredible thing."
Everyone said the same. And so he was to have the princess and half the kingdom, because a law is a law, even if it's the most incredible thing. Trumpets blared from the ramparts and from all the city towers. "Let the wedding proceed." The princess was not at all pleased, but she looked enchanting, and she was pricelessly attired. The church glowed with candles. It was late in the evening, and that's when things look best. The city's noble maidens sang and led forth the bride. The knights sang and led forth the groom. He swaggered as if he could never be snapped in half. Then the singing stopped. It was so quiet that you could have heard a pin hit the ground. But in the midst of the silence, the great church door flew open with a crash and a thunder and bam, bam! There came all the clockworks marching right down the church aisle, halting between the bride and groom. Dead people can't walk again, that's something we know for sure, but a work of art can. The body had been shattered, but not the spirit. The spirit of art was levitating, though this was no matter for levity. The work of art stood there as alive as when it was whole and untouched. It struck the hour, one after the other, all the way to 12, and the figures came swarming out. First, Moses. Flames of fire seemed to blaze from his forehead. He cast the heavy stone tablets of the law at the bridegroom's feet, pinning them to the church floor.
"I can't lift them up again," said Moses. "You've broken off my arms. Stay right where you're standing."
Then came Adam and Eve. the three wise men from the east, and the four seasons of the year. Each of them told him unpleasant truths. Shame on you! But he was not ashamed. All the figures that appeared at each stroke of the hour stepped out of the clock, and all of them grew to a terrifying size. There hardly seemed room left for the real people. And then, at the stroke of 12, when the watchman emerged wearing his fur cap and carrying his morning star, a strange commotion ensued. The watchman went right up to the bridegroom and struck him on the forehead with a morning star. "Lie there," he said, "a blow for a blow. We are avenged, and master is too. Now we will go." And so the entire work of art disappeared. But the candles all around in the church became great flowers of light, and the gilded stars on the ceiling flashed long, clear rays. The organ began playing all on its own. Everyone said that it was the most incredible thing they had ever witnessed. "Then let's summon the right person," said the princess, "the one who made the work of art. He shall be my husband and lord." And he stood in the church with all the people accompanying him. Everyone rejoiced, everyone blessed him. There was not one person who was jealous. Yes, that was the most incredible thing of all.
Auntie Toothache. Where did we get this story? Do you want to know? We got it from the barrel, the one with the old paper in it. Many a good and rare book has ended up at the grocer's or at the delicatessen, not as reading material, but as a basic necessity. They need it to make paper twists to hold starch and coffee beans, and as wrapping paper for salt herring, butter and cheese. Handwritten materials can also be used. Things often end up in the bin that shouldn't be in the bin. I know a grocery boy, the son of a delicatessen owner. He rose up from working in the cellar to the main shop, a boy who has read widely, paper twist reading, both printed and handwritten. He has an interesting collection that includes many important documents, from the waste paper baskets of various busy and absent-minded civil servants, several confidential letters from one girlfriend to another, scandalous reports that were not meant to go any further, were not to be discussed with anyone else. He's a regular rescue society for a not insignificant segment of literature that covers many topics. He has access to the shops of both his parents and employer, and there he has rescued many a book or pages of a book that would be worth reading twice. He showed me his collection of printed and handwritten materials from the bin, the richest items coming from the delicatessen. There were several pages from a lengthy diary. The handwriting was particularly beautiful and clear. It attracted my attention at once. "The student wrote that," he said. "The student who lived right across the street and died a month ago. He suffered from a terrible toothache, as you can see. It's quite amusing to read. There's only a small amount left of what he wrote. It used to be a whole book, and even a little more than that. My parents gave the student's landlady half a pound of green soap for it. Here's what I've managed to salvage. I borrowed it, I read it, and now I'm going to tell you what it said. The title was Auntie Toothache. 1. Auntie gave me sweets when I was little. My teeth survived, they didn't get damaged. Now I've grown up and become a student. She still spoils me with sweets and tells me I'm a poet. I have something of the poet in me, but not enough. Often when I walk along the city streets, I feel as if I were walking through a great library. The buildings are bookshelves, each floor a shelf with books. Over there stands a book about everyday life, there a good old-fashioned comedy, and scholarly works in every field. Over here, risque literature and entertaining stories. I can fantasize and philosophize about all those books. There is something of the poet in me, but not enough. Many people have demonstrated that they possess just as much as I do, and yet they don't wear a sign or a collar that reads, Poet. Both they and I have been granted a gift from God, a blessing, large enough for ourselves, but much too small to be handed out piecemeal to others. It appears like a ray of sunshine, filling soul and mind. It appears like the scent of a flower, like a melody that sounds familiar, yet you can't remember where it's from. On a recent evening, I was sitting in my room, and I felt like reading, but didn't have a book, not even a page. Suddenly, a leaf, fresh and green, fell from the linden tree. The breeze brought it into my room. I examined the branching veins. A little bug was moving over them, as if it wanted to make a thorough study of the leaf. That made me think about human wisdom. We too crawl around on the leaf. It's the only thing we know. And then we immediately start lecturing about the whole big tree, the roots, the trunk, and the crown. The big tree. God, the world, and immortality. Yet of the whole, we know only a little leaf. As I sat there, I had a visit from Auntie Millie. I showed her the leaf with the bug, told her my thoughts, and her eyes lit up. "You're a poet," she said. "Perhaps the greatest we have. If it turns out to be true, I will go to my grave contented. Ever since Brewer Rasmussen's funeral, you've always astonished me with your tremendous imagination." That's what Auntie Millie said, and then she kissed me. Who was Auntie Millie, and who was Brewer Rasmussen? 2. My mother's aunt was known to us children as Auntie. We had no other name for her. She gave us jam and sugar, even though they could cause great harm to our teeth, but she had a weakness for sweet children, she said. It was cruel to deny them the tiny amount of sweets that they loved so much. And that's why we loved Auntie so dearly. She had been an old maid for as long as I could remember, always old. Her age never changed. For years she had suffered terribly from toothaches and was always talking about them, and that's why her friend, Brewer Rasmussen, used his wit and named her Auntie Toothache. He hadn't done any brewing in the past few years, but lived on his interest payments. He often came to see Auntie, and he was older than she was. He had no teeth at all, just a few black stumps. As a child, he had eaten too much sugar, he told us children, and that's what happens. Auntie had apparently never eaten sugar in her childhood. She had the loveliest white teeth. She also used them sparingly, not even sleeping with them at night, Brewer Rasmussen said. We children knew that was a wicked thing to say, but Auntie told us he didn't mean anything by it. One day at lunch she told us about a horrid dream she had had in the night, that one of her teeth had fallen out. "It means," she said, "that I'm going to lose a true friend." "Was it a false tooth?" said the brewer with a chuckle. "If so, then it just means you're going to lose a false friend." "What an uncivil old man you are," said Auntie, more angry than I've ever seen her, either before or since. Later she said that her old friend was just teasing her. He was the noblest person on earth, and one day, when he died, he would become one of God's little angels in heaven. I gave a good deal of thought to this transformation, and to whether I would be able to recognize him in his new form. When Auntie was young, and he was young too, he had proposed to her. She thought about it for too long and didn't make a move, made no move for too long a time, and remained an old maid, but always his faithful friend. And then Brewer Rasmussen died. He was transported to his grave in the most expensive hearse and with a great procession, with people in uniform wearing medals. Dressed in mourning, Auntie stood at the window with all of us children except for little brother. The stork had brought him only the week before. Then the hearse and procession passed. The street was deserted, and Auntie prepared to leave, but I didn't want to leave. I was waiting for the angel, Brewer Rasmussen. He had now become a little winged child of God and would have to put in an appearance. "Auntie," I said, "don't you think he'll come now? Or maybe when the stork brings us another little brother, he'll bring us the angel Rasmussen?" Auntie was quite overwhelmed by my imagination and said, "That child is going to be a great poet." She repeated this during all my school years, yes, even after my confirmation and well into my university days. She was and is the most devoted friend to me when I have both poet aches and toothaches, and I have attacks of both. "Just write down all your thoughts," she said, "and put them away in your desk drawer. That's what Jean-Paul did. He became a great poet, though I'm not especially fond of him. He doesn't excite me. You have to be exciting. And you will be exciting. The night following that speech I lay in bed, filled with longing and agony, with a craving and desire to become the great poet that Auntie saw and sensed in me. I lay there suffering from poet ache. But there is a worse torment, a toothache. It mashed and gnashed me. I became a cringing worm with an herb compress and a Spanish fly plaster. I know what that feels like, said Auntie. There was a sorrowful smile on her lips, and her teeth gleamed so white. But I have to start a new section in the story of my aunt and myself. 3. I moved into new lodgings and had been living there for a month. I told my aunt all about it. I'm living with a quiet family. They don't give me a thought, even if I ring the bell 3 times. And by the way, it's a house full of tumult with the noise and din of wind and storms and people. I live right above the front gate. Every cart that drives in or out makes the pictures on my wall jump. The gate slams and shakes the whole house like an earthquake. If I'm lying in bed, the jolts shudder through all my limbs, but that's supposed to be fortifying to the nerves. If the wind is blowing, and it's always blowing in this country, then the long window latches outside swing back and forth, striking the wall. The bell on the neighbor's gate in the courtyard rings with every gust of wind. The lodgers come trickling home from late in the evening until well into the night. The lodger right above me, who gives trombone lessons during the day, is the last one home and never goes to bed until he has taken a little midnight stroll with heavy footsteps and iron-shod boots. There are no double windows, but there is a broken pane over which the landlady has glued some paper. The wind still blows in through the crack, sounding like a buzzing botfly. That's my bedtime music. When I finally fall asleep, the crowing rooster soon wakes me up. The rooster and hens in the chicken coop kept by the cellar tenant announce that morning is about to arrive. The little ponies have no stable. They're tethered in the storeroom under the stairs, and they kick at the door and panelling as they try to move about. The day dawns. The porter, who sleeps in the garret with his family, thunders down the stairs. His wooden clogs clatter, the gate slams, the house shakes, and when that's over, the lodger above me starts his exercises, lifting in each hand a heavy iron ball, which he can never hold on to. They drop over and over again, while at the same time the youths of the house, who are off to school, come rushing out, shrieking. I go over to the window and open it to get some fresh air. It's a relief when I can get it, provided the woman in the back building isn't washing gloves in stain remover, which is how she makes a living. And, by the way, it's a nice place, and I live with a quiet family. That's the summary I gave Auntie about my lodgings. I told it in a much livelier fashion, since spoken words have a fresher sound to them than written words. "You're a poet!" cried Auntie. "Just write down what you told me, and you're as good as Dickens. Yes, now you're much more interesting to me. You paint when you speak. You describe your house so I can see it. It makes me shiver. Keep writing. Put something alive into it. People, charming people, preferably unhappy ones." I actually did write down my description of the house, the way it stands there with all its din and defects, but I only put myself in it, without any plot. That came later. 4. One evening that winter, after the theatres had closed, a terrible storm blew in, a snowstorm, that made it almost impossible to move. Auntie had gone to the theatre, and I was there to escort her home, but I was having trouble enough walking on my own, let alone accompanying anyone else. The hansom cabs had all been taken. Auntie lived a good distance away in the city, while my own lodgings were close to the theatre. If that had not been the case, we would have had to seek shelter in the sentry box for the time being. We staggered forward through the deep snow with whirling snowflakes rushing around us. I lifted her, I held her, I shoved her along. Only twice did we fall, but we fell softly. We reached my gate where we shook off the snow. On the stairs we shook ourselves again, yet still had enough snow to cover the floor in the entryway. We took off our overcoats and undercoats and every garment that could be removed. The landlady loaned Auntie dry stockings and a dressing gown. She would need them, said the landlady. and added quite truthfully that it would be impossible for my aunt to return home that night. She invited Auntie to make herself comfortable in the parlour. There she would make up the sofa in front of the connecting door to my room that was always kept locked. And that's what happened. The fire burned in my stove, the tea urn was set on the table, the little room grew quite pleasant, although not as pleasant as Auntie's parlour in the wintertime, with its thick curtains over the doors, thick curtains at the windows, and double carpets with three layers of thick paper underneath. Sitting there is like being in a tightly corked bottle filled with warm air, although, as I said, it was also quite pleasant in my room. The wind was whistling outside. Auntie talked and told stories. Her youth reappeared. The brewer reappeared, and old memories. She could remember when I got my first tooth and how the family rejoiced. My first tooth. The tooth of innocence, gleaming like a little white drop of milk. My baby tooth. One appeared, more appeared, a whole row of them, side by side, top and bottom, the loveliest baby teeth. Yet they were just the advance troops, not the real ones that would last my whole life. They, too, appeared along with my wisdom teeth, the flank guards in the row, born with pain and great trouble. They'll leave again, every one of them. They'll leave before their time of service is over. Even the very last tooth will leave, and that is not a day for celebrating, that is a day for grieving. By then you're old, even though your spirits may be young. Such thoughts and discussions are not enjoyable, yet we happened to talk about all these things. We returned to my childhood years, talking and talking. It was midnight before Auntie went to bed in the parlour next door. "Good night, sweet child," she called. "I'm going to sleep as snugly as if I were in my own bed." She settled in peacefully, but there was no peace either inside the house or outdoors. The storm rattled the windows, battered the long dangling iron latches, and rang the neighbour's doorbell in the back courtyard. The lodger upstairs had come home. He was still taking a little night-time stroll back and forth. Then he threw off his boots and got into bed to sleep, but he snores so loudly that anyone with good ears can hear it through the ceiling. I couldn't sleep, couldn't find any peace. The weather couldn't find peace either. It was terribly lively. The wind whistled and sang in its own way. My teeth started to get lively too. They whistled and sang in their own way. They were getting ready for a bad toothache. A draught came from the window. The moon was shining on the floor. The light came and went, the way clouds come and go in stormy weather. There was a restless shifting of shadow and light, but at last the shadow on the floor took shape. I looked at this moving form and felt an icy gust. On the floor sat a figure, tall and thin, the kind a child draws with a pencil on a slate, something that is supposed to look like a person. A single thin line forms the body. One line and then another form the arms. The legs are each one line, the head a polygon. Soon the figure grew more distinct. It was wearing a sort of gown, very thin, very fine, but this showed that the figure was female. I heard a buzzing. Was it her or the wind that was droning like a bot fly through the crack in the pane? No, it was her. Madam Toothache. Her Horrible Highness. Satania Infernalis. God save us from her visits. "How nice it is here," she hummed. "Such nice quarters. Marshy ground, boggy ground. The mosquitoes have buzzed around here with poison in their stingers. Now I have the stinger, and it has to be sharpened on human teeth. They're shining so white in this fellow in the bed. They've braved sweet and sour, hot and cold, nutshells and plum pits. But I'll smack them and whack them. I'll mulch the roots with a draughty gust and give them cold feet." What a horrible speech! What a horrible guest! "Oh, so you're a poet," she said.
Well, I'm going to write you into all the verses of pain. I'm going to give you iron and steel in your body. Put fiber into all the fibers of your nerves.
It felt as if a glowing awl were passing through my cheekbone. I twisted and writhed.
What excellent teeth, she said. An organ to play on. A mouth organ concert. How splendid. With kettle drums and trumpets, piccolos and trombones in the wisdom tooth. Great poet. Great music.
Oh, yes. She started playing, and how horrible she looked, even though I could see no more of her than her hand, that shadowy grey ice-cold hand with the long fingers as thin as awls. Each of them was a torture instrument. Her thumb and index finger were the pincers and screw. Her middle finger ended in a sharp awl. Her ring finger was a gimlet, and her little finger a syringe full of mosquito poison.
"I'll teach you metered verse," she said. A big poet will have a big toothache. A little poet, a little toothache.
Oh, let me be little, I begged. Let me not be one at all. I'm not a poet. I just have attacks of poetry. Attacks, like toothaches. Go away, go away.
Then do you acknowledge that I'm mightier than poetry, philosophy, mathematics, and all music, she said. Mightier than all those painted and marble-carved sensations. I'm older than all of them. I was born close to the Garden of Eden, outside where the wind blew and the damp toadstools grew. I made Eve put on clothes in the cold wind, and Adam, too. Believe me, the first toothache was a powerful one.
I believe everything, I said. Go away, go away!
Well, if you'll give up being a poet, never set verse to paper, slate, or any form of writing material again, then I'll let you go. But I'll be back if you ever start writing.
I swear, I said, if only I never see or feel you again.
But you will see me, though in a more substantial form, one that is dearer to you than I am now. You will see me as Auntie Millie. And I'll say, right, my sweet boy, you're a great poet, perhaps the greatest we have. But believe me, if you start writing, then I'll set your verses to music and play them on your mouth organ, you sweet child. Think of me when you see Auntie Millie.
Then she vanished. In farewell, I got what felt like a glowing awl jabbed into my jaw, but it soon faded. I felt as if I were floating on gentle water. I saw the white water lilies with the broad green leaves droop, sink below me, wither, dissolve, and I sank with them, dissolving into peace and rest. Die, melt away like the snow, is what I heard singing and ringing in the water. Evaporate into the clouds. Pass on like the clouds. Shining down through the water toward me were big, bright names, inscriptions on fluttering victory banners, the proclamation of immortality, written on the wings of a mayfly. My slumber was deep, slumber without dreams. I didn't hear the whistling wind, the slamming gate, the neighbor's doorbell ringing, or the vigorous exercises of the lodger. What bliss! Then came a gust of wind so strong that the locked door to Auntie's room blew open. Auntie leaped to her feet, pulled on her shoes, put on her clothes, and came into my room. I was sleeping like one of God's angels, she said, and she couldn't bear to wake me. I awoke on my own, opened my eyes, and had completely forgotten that Auntie was in the house. But I quickly remembered my toothache vision. Dream and reality merged into one.
"You didn't happen to write anything last night after we said good night, did you?" she asked. "How I wish that you had. You're my poet, and you always will be."
I thought she smiled so slyly. I couldn't tell if it was the real Auntie Millie who loved me or the horrible one to whom I had given my promise in the night.
"Have you written anything, sweet child?"
No, no, I cried. But you're Auntie Millie.
Who else? She said. And she was Auntie Millie.
She kissed me, got into a hansom cab and drove home. I wrote all of this down. It's not in verse, and it will never be published. And that's where the manuscript ended. My young friend, the budding delicatessen owner, couldn't find the missing pages. They had gone out into the world as wrapping paper for salted herring, butter, and green soap. They had fulfilled their destiny. The brewer is dead, Auntie is dead, and the student is dead, the one whose sparks of genius ended up in the bin. Everything ends up in the bin. And that's the end of the story. The story about Auntie Toothache.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Fairy Tales by Hans Christian Andersen. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Dan Musselman. Fairy Tales is a production of Penguin Audio and Books on Tape. Copyright 2005, all rights reserved. The book Fairy Tales is available wherever Viking books are sold.